Civil War legislation and non-military legislation, where he said that the war ushered in 4 decades of neo-Hamiltonianism, which is basically crony capitalism, government for the privileged few, and I think that is exactly right, exactly what happened, which is why I think the American Civil War was such a big breaking point in economic policy in America. And so I thought I'd start by continuing my discussion of the tariff story, keeping in mind that in the at this period of American history, 1860, tariff revenue, tariffs on imports accounted for at least 90%, in some years more, of all federal tax revenue. And so that's why there was a big decades-long fight over tariff policy. It was the big tax people like Henry Clay and Lincoln and Hamilton versus the advocates of lower taxation, the Jeffersonians, that fought this battle. And so by the time you get to 1857, the year 1857, the Jeffersonians had been winning. The tariff rate was down to about, on average, 15%. It was 15% on average. And that was the high water mark in terms of free trade in America in the 19th century. Then there was a depression at that time. And the Republican Party, which was fairly new, it was only a couple years old, took the depression of 1857 as an excuse to put forth yet again their case for protectionist tariffs to protect American jobs. And they eventually succeeded in getting the Morrill Tariff passed. It's spelled M-O-R-R-I-L-L, named after Congressman Justin Morrill of Vermont, who was also a steel manufacturer. And that was passed in the 1859-1860 session of Congress in the House of Representatives. And this is before any state seceded, before the war, before Lincoln was elected, and so forth. And so the Morrill Tariff was not a war tariff. It was an attempt to finally push through protectionist tariffs along the lines of the 1828 Tariff of Abominations. And so they succeeded in doing that. And now along comes Lincoln at this point, who picked up the Hamiltonian mantle. Henry Clay died in 1852, and Lincoln became the leader of the Whigs, the Whig Party imploded, and most of the old interventionist Whigs became Republicans. In fact, every single member of Lincoln's cabinet was a former Whig, every single one of them. And so these were the same people. These were the same people as Hamilton and Story and Marshall and all the Hamiltonians. Ideologically, they were all birds of a feather. And so Lincoln himself owed everything, owed his nomination to the protectionists in the Republican Party in the northern states. And there's an article about this that I've cited in some of my writings by a man named Bernard Lucan. It was in the American Historical Review in the 1940s, and it was called Lincoln and the Tariff. And Bernard Lucan explains how Lincoln, when he was politicking, he and his supporters from Chicago were politicking for him to get the nomination as president. They knew that they needed the support of the Pennsylvania delegation. It was the second biggest delegation next to New York. And so what they did, and this was, of course, even at that time, 1860, a center for steel manufacturing and other kinds of manufacturing. And so Lincoln got his friend David Davis, who he later appointed to the Supreme Court, to go with all of his old speeches advocating protectionist tariffs, to show them to all the big shot Republicans in Pennsylvania, like Simon Cameron and Thaddeus Stevens and people of that sort, to guarantee them that he was their man. He was always, for 25 years, had been an ardent protectionist. And he sent a private emissary with these speeches, the original copies of his speeches, and he instructed David Davies to not make any of these conversations public. Don't let it get into the media. And the main reason why is that he wanted the votes and the support of the Pennsylvania manufacturers. But the farmers of America were always harmed disproportionately by protectionist tariffs, because farmers everywhere, not just southern farmers, but farmers anywhere, exported a lot. Southern farmers exported about 3/4 of everything, and so did Midwestern farmers and Pennsylvania farmers. They exported a lot, maybe not 3/4, but a lot. And it was well known then, as it is now in, among students of economics, that a tariff, which is a tax on imports, eventually becomes or turns into tax on exports. And let me read the explanation of this, a very simple explanation of this point, by Milton Friedman in his famous book with his wife Rose, Free to Choose. He explains this concept. He says this: if tariffs are imposed on, say, textiles, that will add to output and employment in the textile industry. However, foreign producers who can no longer sell their textiles in the United States earn fewer dollars. They will have less to spend in the United States. Exports will go down to the balance to balance the decreased imports. So in other words, a tax on imports, protectionist tariffs, will impoverish our trading partners. They in turn will have less money that they can use to buy American goods. They'll have fewer dollars, and you need dollars to buy American goods. What kind of American goods are they buying? Mostly agricultural goods in this period of history. And so the farmers were disproportionately harmed, because it, not only did they have to pay more for the manufactured goods, farm tools and blankets and clothing that were protected from competition by the tariff, but on top of that, like everyone else did, but on top of that, their business dried up overseas. So they were hit twice. And so Lincoln understood this. Everyone understood this at the time. And so he didn't want to lose the vote and get the farmers against him. And so he had to keep this secret. And so the historian Bernard Lutham explains how Lincoln owed everything politically to the support of protectionism. And so he did get the Pennsylvania delegation behind him. And when he went back home victoriously to Springfield, Illinois, there were large banners proclaiming what would become the theme of his campaign: protection for the home industry. Protection for the home industry. Okay, and so this was the key component of the Republican Party platform of 1860: protectionist tariffs. It's how they intended to fund the Transcontinental Railroad and the empire that they wanted to build, and the larger army, and on and on and on. This was the major source of income. It was the cornerstone of the Republican Party platform, and Lincoln was the man. He was the 25-year record of being among the most ardent protectionists, like Hamilton, in the United States. And so he got the nomination, and his official campaign poster, there were several of them, but one of them said, had a picture of Lincoln and Hannibal Hamlin, his vice president, and said, "Protection for home industry." Now, the moral tariff was passed by the House of Representatives in the 1859-1860 session, and then it was passed by the United States Senate and signed by the predecessor of Lincoln 2 days before his inauguration. So he was inaugurated on March 4th, 1861. On March 2nd, James Buchanan, his predecessor, signed it into law. Buchanan was from Pennsylvania. And so naturally, a Pennsylvania politician would have signed on to a protectionist tariff law. And this increased the average tariff rate from around 15% to over 32%. And Lincoln gives his first inaugural address, which any of you can read. And in the first couple of paragraphs, it's online, of course, the first couple of paragraphs are what I consider to be the strongest defense of slavery ever made by an American politician, because it came from the President of the United States himself, where he says over and over again that he has no intent to disturb Southern slavery. He said, "You can read all of my past speeches. I've always said this." He said, "Besides, it would be unconstitutional for me to do so." And then he says that the purpose, at the end of his speech, at the end of the first inaugural address, he lends his support to a constitutional amendment known as the Corwin Amendment. C-O-R-W-I-N is how it's spelled, named after a member of Congress, that would have prohibited the federal government from ever interfering in slavery, ever. And Lincoln supported that verbally in his first inaugural address. And he did not support the actual 13th Amendment that was passed at the end of the Civil War that ended slavery, contrary to Steven Spielberg's phony movie about that. And your source on that is the preeminent Lincoln scholar of our time, David Donald, in his book Lincoln that won the Pulitzer Prize. He says right in there that Lincoln did nothing to get the 13th Amendment passed. Even when he was asked to help get the 13th Amendment passed in 1865, he refused. He said, no thanks, I'm not going to bother. And so, so he made this powerful defense of slavery in his first inaugural address. And then in the same speech, he says, it is my duty to collect the duties and imposts, tariffs. But beyond that, there will be no invasion of any state. So he literally threatened invasion, a military invasion of any state government that refused to collect the federal tariff tax, which had just been doubled, more than doubled. And so federal taxes had been more than doubled 2 days earlier, and he was not going to back down like Andrew Jackson did some 30 years earlier to the South Carolina nullifiers or any other nullifiers of the new tax. He threatened war, and he came through with his threat. He threatened war over taxation, and when the southern states said, we do not intend to send tax dollars to Washington, D.C., he carried through his threat and went to war. And so, and of course, Lincoln himself stated, as did the United States Congress, that the sole purpose of the war was to save the Union and not to disturb southern slavery. The Congress issued a formal declaration that said that, and Lincoln said it also many times, including in a famous letter that he wrote to Horace Greeley, the newspaper man, where he said, my ultimate objective is to save the Union, and if I could do that by freeing some slaves and leaving others in bondage, I would do that. If I could do it by freeing no slaves, I would do that, and so forth. And you can look that up on the web if you're interested in this period of American history. Just type in Lincoln's letter to Horace Greeley, and you'll find it. And so the protectionist tariff went up more than double, and Lincoln signed off on 10 more tariff increases during his administration, so that by the end of the war, the average tariff rate was in the 45 to 50% range, and it would remain in that range until the year 1913. Until the federal income tax came in. And so this was not a war tariff. As I said, it was passed originally before Lincoln was elected, before any southern state seceded. It was the policy of the Republican Party. They were the party of protectionism, always have been. And so we had some 50 years of protectionist trade policy. And as a result, the farmers were disproportionately burdened or discriminated against economically during all that time, and they eventually became a powerful voting bloc for a federal income tax, because they were promised that some of the burden would be taken off them with lower tariff rates if they, the farmers, supported the federal income tax in 1913 thereabouts, which they did. And so they helped get the Constitutional Amendment passed, the 16th Amendment, to create a federal income tax later. But that's the subject of 2 weeks from now, the federal income tax. And so the cornerstone of Hamiltonianism, protectionist tariffs, was finally cemented into place after being battled over in politics from the time of Hamilton up through Henry Clay's shenanigans in the 1820s and 1830s. Until the Jeffersonians won the day up through the 1850s, but when Lincoln came in and the South seceded during the war, the Republican Party had its way, and they were the Hamiltonians, and so they got the tariff. And when the war ended, they did not reduce the tariff. There was no ratchet effect of the tariff, to cite a phrase made popular by Robert Higgs in his famous book *Crisis and Leviathan*. There was no ratchet with the tariff. The tariff was up in the 50% range for 50 years. And the amount of the U.S. economy that was involved in international trade at the time was less than 10%. And so the Industrial Revolution took place despite the fact that the trade sector of the economy was hampered or hindered or hamstrung by the high protectionist tariffs. And the farm sector was disproportionately harmed during all this time by high protectionist tariffs. But the other 90 to 92% of the economy boomed. This was the Industrial Revolution in America in the late 19th century. So that was plank number one of the great Hamiltonian victory that took place during the American Civil War. The second plank, you know, a national bank was not achieved. They did not bring back the Bank of the United States. However, there were three legal tender acts and the National Currency Act. And these laws created the greenback dollar. And then they also imposed a tax, a 10% tax, on all competing currencies issued by the states. And so the objective was to nationalize the money supply and drive the competing currencies out of the market, which they did. And so we got the greenback dollar, and the price level in the northern states about doubled within a year as a result of that. And I dug up a couple of quotes about this by some Republican politicians of the time. One is from Horace Greeley, newspaper man and supporter of the Republican Party. And he's writing about the National Currency Act of 1863. He said, "The purpose of this measure is to institute such a connection between the public credit and the banking interest as shall, on the one hand, give the president virtual control of all the banks of the country, and, on the other, make every stockholder and banknote holder in the land an underwriter, so to speak, of the government bonds, effectively harmonizing the interests of both government and the people." Okay, the New York Times, which is Hamilton's hometown newspaper, wrote an editorial rejoicing about the National Currency Act. It said this, "So the National Currency Act crystallized a centralization of power such as Hamilton might have eulogized as magnificent. So give the government control of the money supply, a monopoly control over the currency, and it can centralize all power." And it certainly did. There's an economist, a well-known early 20th century economist, Wesley Clair Mitchell, who did a lot of studies of the monetary history during the Civil War era and other eras. And he calculated that as a result of the inflation, the price inflation created by the greenback dollar, that northern taxpayers paid more than $500 million more for the war, for the Civil War, as a result. And of course, real wages fell during the same time because the price level had gone up. And so this was the system that was put into place during the Lincoln regime, and was kept in place until the Fed came into being in 1913. There wasn't a central bank, but there was a federal regulation of banking, and there was a monopoly currency, the greenback. And there was quite a few studies of this era, you know, the banking system during that time. And one study of this by Anna Schwartz, who was Milton Friedman's co-author in his famous book, A Monetary History of the United States. But she co-authored another article in a book on monetary history edited by Claudia Golden, G-O-L-D-I-N is how it's spelled. And they looked at this period of history from the Civil War in the 1860s with the National Currency Act to the turn of the 20th century. And they wrote that this system that was created was, quote, "characterized by monetary and cyclical instability, poor banking panics, frequent stock market crashes, and other financial disturbances." And let me give you the citation for anyone who's interested. That's an article by Michael Bordo, Peter Rappaport, and Anna Schwartz, and it's in a book by Claudia Golden, G-O-L-D-I-N, and the title of the book is Strategic Factors in 19th Century American Economic Growth. Strategic Factors in 19th Century American Economic Growth, and Bordo, Rappaport, and Schwartz are the authors of the collection of readings. And so it created tremendous instability, but That didn't matter. The point was it nationalized the currency, and it created a tremendously centralized political power in Washington, D.C. That was the purpose. The purpose was never to stabilize the currency. That's the false story that some economists have told, certainly not the Austrians, but the people who are the excuse makers for central banking and central bankers. That's the story they'll tell you. And so the second big plank of the American system was nailed into place during the Lincoln regime, during the Civil War, with the National Currency Acts. And that was a giant leap in the direction of a central bank, which the United States would eventually get in the year 1913. Well, the third plank, of course, was corporate welfare. And Abraham Lincoln was the king of corporate welfare. He was a railroad lawyer and lobbyist. That's how he became the nominee of the Republican Party. The Whig Party was the party of the moneyed elite of the North. Lincoln was a Whig for 28 years. His party was the party of the Northern moneyed elite. When the Whig Party imploded, these people became Republicans, and they chose Lincoln as their standard bearer. And he was a wealthy, hyper-politically connected railroad lobbyist and lawyer, even though in those days they didn't use the word lobbyist, I don't believe. And there's a book called Lincoln and the Railroads by an author named Starr, S-T-A-R-R. And forget his first name, but S-T-A-R-R. Lincoln and the Railroads. And here's what he said. He said, Lincoln's close relations with powerful industrial interests were always potent and present in political councils. He said, Lincoln's rise in politics was coincident with that of the railroad, and it certainly was. He represented the Illinois Central, which is probably the biggest railroad in the country. He also represented, as their lawyer, the Chicago and Alton, Ohio and Mississippi, and Rock Island Railroads. Then he represented the Chicago and Mississippi Railroad. And in 1860, he was probably the most sought-after railroad attorney in the United States. And he was offered the job of general counsel of the New York Central Railroad by Erastus Corning, which he turned down. And so Lincoln was the candidate. He wasn't really the candidate. Presidential candidate from Illinois. He was the presidential candidate from the Illinois Central Railroad. That's who got him elected. And so, he was so connected that in 1857, he purchased a big tract of land in Council Bluffs, Iowa. And when he became president in June of 1861, the war was on. They were planning the first big battle of Manassas was impending. Lincoln called a special session of Congress to get the Pacific Railway Act legislation started, which they did. And it took them about a year, and they passed the Pacific Railway Act, which subsidized the government-created Union Pacific and Central Pacific Railroads. And so finally, the genie was out of the bottle with regard to corporate welfare. After all these presidents in the past had vetoed legislation to use federal tax dollars for internal improvements, for road building, canal building, railroad subsidies. This was all gone now. This was finally achieved with the Pacific Railway Act. And the Pacific Railway Act gave the president the right to determine the eastern terminus, that is, the starting point of the building of the government-subsidized transcontinental railroad. And guess what? Lincoln chose Council Bluffs, Iowa. So he must have made a killing on the property, which is why his family and after his death was very wealthy. His kid Todd was very wealthy and ended up becoming a cabinet member in the Roosevelt administration, and so he certainly became part of the elite after his father's death. And so also it created a dynasty of Republican Party barons. In his famous book, Hear That Lonesome Whistle Blow, about the building of the Transcontinental Railroads, D. Brown, D-E-E, is how he spelled his name. He passed away a few years ago. Ebron was the American historian of the American West. He wrote many books about the American West. Bury My Heart, It Wounded Me, is a famous one. He said this, when Lincoln signed this legislation, quote, he assured the fortunes of a dynasty of American families, the Brewsters, Bushnells, Alcotts, Parkers, Harrisons, Trowbridges, Landworthies, Reeds, Ogdens, Bradfords, Noises, Crooks, Cornells, and dozens of others. And there was a lot of vote trading by Republican members of Congress who said, I'll vote for this law, but only if I get stock in the companies or you buy steel from my company. Thaddeus Stevens made that deal. He insisted on part of the law being requiring American-made steel. And of course, he was a steel manufacturer. And so corporate welfare was run amok. The floodgates were open to corporate welfare. And once the railroad industry got their corporate welfare, every other industry in America started going to Washington and asking, where's mine? Where's mine? And of course, this led exactly to what Jeffersonians always predicted was corruption. It led to the Crédit Mobilier scandal. It's C-R-E-I-D-I-T. And the second word is M-O-B-I-L-I-E-R, the French word. And because of the insider dealing that took place between, among the people who ran this the government-subsidized railroads. And the government-subsidized railroads were notoriously inefficient. They even built railroad tracks on the top of ice and snow in the wintertime in the Rocky Mountains because they were subsidized by the mile. And the more miles of track you built, the more money you collected from the tax till. And so when the spring thaw came and the snow melted and the tracks collapsed, you got paid again for building more tracks. And so it was very inefficient. And both of these companies were bankrupt at the time. They celebrated the completion at Promontory Point of the rail line. In sharp contrast to the Great Northern Railroad that was built by James J. Hill and was built with private funds and not even any government land grants, which was the case with the government railroads. He paid for them right away, even through Indian land. James J. Hill even paid the Indians with cattle, livestock of various kinds, money, whatever they could trade for to go through their territory, whereas the government-subsidized railroads simply called the army in and had them kill all the Indians. And so they socialized the cost in that way of building the government-subsidized railroads. And so it ended up in scandal and grotesque inefficiency, as was always predicted by the Jeffersonians. But all of that grotesque inefficiency and all that corruption meant tremendous wealth for politically connected Republicans. Things never changed, apparently. And so this, the third plank of Hamiltonianism, corporate welfare, was put into place with the government-subsidized transcontinental railroads. And so by the time you get to the late 19th century, you still have the Hamiltonian hegemony taking place. I mentioned two books in the chat before the class, and one of them was by Gabriel Kolko, The Triumph of Conservatism, and the other one is a very similar book by Butler Schaefer, In Restraint of Trade. They're about how big corporations in America were always behind in support of government regulation of their industries because they were always confident that they could control the regulation, they could control the regulators. Another book that I would recommend is The Citizen and the State by George Stigler. This book was cited when George Stigler was awarded the Nobel Prize in economics back in the 1980s. And it's along the lines of these other two books. And for example, when the Interstate Commerce Commission was created in 1887 to supposedly regulate the railroads in the public interest, the first head of the Interstate Commerce Commission was a railroad industry president. And one of the first things they did was to outlaw price cutting or discounts. Some of the railroads were giving quantity discounts to people like John D. Rockefeller, who was shipping millions of barrels of oil a year around the country. And so, like any good business people, they were giving quantity discounts to their biggest customers. The smaller customers complained that they were not getting the discounts. So the government came in and said, okay, nobody gets the discounts. We'll make it illegal to give Mr. Rockefeller a discount. And so they created a price-fixing scheme for the benefit of the railroad, and they essentially cartelized a large part of the railroad industry through government regulation. The same sort of thing happened a little later on in American history with the creation of the Food and Drug Administration, the Food and Drug Act. It was the large food manufacturers who were behind it because they knew it would create very onerous and costly regulations that would be harmful to their smaller competitors, and it would make their industry more monopolistic. When you get into the era of the so-called natural monopolies, the regulation of the utilities, read my article, The Myth of Natural Monopolies, from the Review of Austin Economics some years ago. I tell the whole story of how there was vigorous competition in the electric power industry, telephone industry, and so forth in the late 19th, early 20th centuries. And some of these companies tried over and over again to form cartels or price-fixing cartels, but competition always spoiled them, and cheating on the cartels always busted up the cartels. But they finally succeeded when they started convincing state government politicians to grant them monopoly licenses and then splitting the loops with the politicians at the state and local level. In the state of Maryland, for example, in my article, I quote a book called The Gaslight Company of Baltimore, which is a history of the Baltimore Gas and Electric Company. And it explains how so-called natural monopoly regulation came into being in Maryland. And it's the same story of every other state, where the gaslight company was sick and tired of all these competitors coming into the state and dropping the price of their product. And so they cut a deal with the state legislature in Maryland that they said, give us a monopoly grant and we will pay you, I think it was $10,000 plus 15% of all gross revenue year after year after year. So it was a form of hidden taxation. And it benefited the politicians because it gave them more money to spread around to buy votes with. And of course, it was beneficial to the company because they became a monopoly. And then supposedly the government said that they would regulate the electric utilities, in the public interest and keep the price down. But as George Stigler shows in his book that I mentioned, The Citizen and the State, he did a series of statistical studies showing that the effect was that electric utility rates went up, not down. And so it was a monopoly scheme through and through, and it was pure Hamiltonianism, business and government collaboration. That's whenever business and government collaborate, it's time to hold on to your wallet. And that's exactly what happened. And so these two books, The Restraint of Trade by Butler Schaefer and The Triumph of Conservatism by Gabriel Colter, which was published much earlier, tell this whole story. And if we fast forward to the 1930s, I would also argue that the first New Deal was also another triumph of Hamiltonianism. The so-called New Deal in the United States was very similar to fascism in Germany and Italy. The two big programs of the New Deal in the United States was the National Industrial Recovery Act, which had to do with the manufacturing sector, and the Agricultural Adjustment Act, which affected the agricultural sector. Now, the National Industrial Recovery Act essentially imposed price floors on thousands of items manufactured in the United States. They suspended the antitrust laws, and the government became the enforcer of price fixing in literally thousands of products. All around the United States, their cockeyed theory was that low prices caused the Great Depression, therefore if the government were to prop up prices, the Great Depression will end. And so they tried mightily for several years. They hired thousands of price control police to police prices. There was even a man named Jack McGigg, his name is spelled M-A-G-I-G, who was a tailor, a tailor of men's clothing in New Jersey, who was sent to jail for tailoring a pair of men's pants for a price lower than the official government-imposed price. I think he did it for something like 35 cents instead of the 50 cents that the government insisted he charge. for a company putting cuffs on a pair of men's pants. And so we had this price code Gestapo running all around New York City and other cities trying to prop up prices. And there you have your government business collaboration in fine Hamiltonian style. And the same sort of thing was going on in agriculture with price supports, with acreage allotments, government ordering farmers to reduce the number of acres they planted. The government actually at one point went out and slaughtered thousands of animals to try to drive up the price of meat at a time when people were standing in soup lines. And the government wised up after that because it was bad public relations. And so they started paying farmers for not raising livestock and not growing food in the first place to try to prop up prices. But by 1935, the United States Supreme Court ruled that both of these programs were unconstitutional. But the Hamiltonians never give up. Franklin Roosevelt kept up the National Recovery Act kind of programs by calling the AAA programs soil conservation, for example. They kept restricting the production of farming by calling it soil conservation and not an economic program. And so there you have the Hamiltonian hegemony. When I started out tonight by saying that, quoting Leonard Curry, the historian who wrote the book on the domestic legislation during the American Civil War, saying that it ushered in four decades of Hamiltonianism. It was much more than four decades. You go right up through the New Deal, which was pure Hamiltonianism in the first New Deal anyway. The second New Deal had more to do with labor legislation and the Social Security Act and things like that. But the first New Deal was economic fascism, which is just another word for Hamiltonianism in terms of economic policy. And so this was economic nationalism run amok. And of course, none of this ended the Great Depression. It only made things worse. One of the first lessons of any microeconomics textbook, mainstream, Austrian, or otherwise, is that cartels, if you attempt to join into a cartel and arrange to restrict or reduce output through collusion, what are you doing? You're reducing production. And when you reduce production, what do you do to employment? Well, you reduce employment. Businesses don't need as many people working for them if they're not producing as much in an attempt to drive up prices. And so what the first New Deal did was to create unemployment, make unemployment much higher than it otherwise would have been. And I wrote about this in an article on Mises.org years ago entitled The New Deal Debunked Again. Among other places, I also wrote about it in my book, How Capitalism Saved America. And so I think that's about what I wanted to say for tonight about Hamiltonian hegemony and how it played itself out. You know, I've covered a lot of history here in about 40 minutes, but I think those are the high points of what has happened in terms of Hamiltonian hegemony during this period. And so I'll do what we usually do, and I'll look for questions or that you might have about anything. I see Cam is doing his usual great job with all the links. There's the letter to Horace Greeley and everything. Good job, Cam. And I'll sit around and wait to see if anyone has any questions. I'll do the Q&A. I don't see any so far. There's no requirement to ask questions. We believe in laissez-faire around here. Let's see, here's a couple. Let's see, James Blackson asked, what date was the Pacific Railroad Act passed? That was 1862. So after the war started. The war started in 1861 in April. And in June of 1861, Lincoln called a special session of Congress, and a year later, about almost exactly a year later, it finally passed, and Lincoln signed it. What did the South think of the act? Well, there had been a debate. You know, there were Southern politicians who were not opposed to government subsidies for railroads, as long as at least some of the railroad went through the Southern states. And so there were advocates in the Southern states of corporate welfare. But by the time you get to the late 1850s, there were twice as many Northern states as Southern states. The congressional representation was overwhelming the South. And so they knew that if it came down to a vote, that they would lose. That if they're going to give government subsidies to a railroad to be built to the West Coast, it was going to go to the Northern states because they did not have the votes in the Southern states anymore. And so they knew that. Regarding the second Bank of the United States, it issued currency itself, it issued loans, it made loans. It was a depository of tax dollars. It was mostly capitalized. The original Bank of the United States was 80% capitalized by private capital. And so, yeah, it did make loans. Was there an official central bank established during the Civil War? No, there was no Fed during the Civil War. James Laxton is asking, what was the second platform of the Republican Party? I'm not sure what you mean by that, James. Second platform. Maybe you mean the 1864 platform? I'm not sure what you mean by that. Any other questions? Oh, you mean plank? Well, there are many planks. There are many planks of the Republican Party platform. I believe one of the articles I put on the reading list for tonight was Why the Republican Party Elected Lincoln. It was a web article of mine. And it was from the horse's mouth. I quoted Senator John Sherman. And it said, you know, to carry out our platform of subsidies for the build of railroads, the Homestead Act, which I didn't mention tonight, a high protectionist tariff, and of course, National Currency Acts, all these things. That's according to the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, Senator John Sherman, who was, you know, one of the big leaders of the Republican Party at the time. The reason why they had Lincoln as their man was they thought he would do the best job in getting their platform, protectionist tariffs, corporate welfare, and the Homestead Act. There had been a debate going on over, you know, the government laid claim to all the land, all the territory, you know, it's ours. And so there had been an ongoing debate over how to disperse this land. Southerners, by and large, wanted the government to sell the land, because they wanted to use those revenues from land sales, to take the pressure off the tariff. They thought the tariff rate could be lowered if the government could finance its constitutional functions partly through land sales. The Northerners, by and large, wanted to give away the land as a sort of a political patronage plum, which they did. And so when they got into power with the Homestead Act, the great majority of the land was given away to corporations. There was a lot of land given away to individuals. 160 acres was the plot of land that was given to individuals if you farmed it for 2 years. But more than half of it was given away to railroad, mining, and forestry corporations who were the benefactors of the Republican Party. And so that's also a part of what was going on here. That was also a big part of the corporate welfare victory of the Hamiltonians, was the Homestead Act. Yes, there's a question by Bob. Yes, once the Southerners seceded, that was always the main opposition to the American system, to Hamiltonianism. And also when the Southerners seceded, you know, the debate over slavery had been not over Southern slavery. The Republican Party platform of 1860 pledged not to disturb Southern slavery. It was the extension of slavery into the territory that was debated. So when the Southern states seceded, they gave up any claim to bring slaves or anything else into the territory because that would no longer be their country. That would be like bringing slaves into France. That's not going to happen. And so they gave up on that. And at the same time, once they left, the Hamiltonians had their way with the U.S. Congress. And also, the Confederate Constitution of 1861 outlawed protectionist tariffs. It also outlawed corporate welfare, with the lone exception of using money for the dredging of harbors. That's the only tax dollar that could have been used for the benefit of any corporation under the Confederate Constitution. And so they actually made unconstitutional the main planks of the American system of Hamiltonianism in the Confederate Constitution. And the reference on that is Marshall DeRosa's book, The Confederate Constitution of 1861. Is there any more questions? Joel is asking about the Lincoln movie. We'll see. I've written two articles on it. Look up, Cam will find it, on LouRockwell.com. The one article I think you should read is Steven Spielberg's Upside Down History on LouRockwell.com. The theme of the Lincoln movie is only about the last couple of months of Lincoln's life, and it's a total lie of the movie. The theme of the movie is Lincoln using his political skills in getting through the House of Representatives the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, which ended slavery. Okay, that's the whole theme of the movie. David Donald is the preeminent Lincoln scholar of our time. He taught at Harvard for many years. His book, Lincoln, won the Pulitzer Prize, as did several of his other books on Lincoln. And his account of Lincoln's role in the 13th Amendment was he did nothing. He was asked by the real abolitionists, people like Thaddeus Stevens, to help them out and get votes. They asked him, for example, they said there were some New Jersey Democrats who they thought could be persuaded to vote for the 13th Amendment ending slavery if Lincoln could get the Senate to drop legislation that had been proposed to regulate the railroads in New Jersey. So these members of Congress, one of whom worked for a New Jersey railroad, were opposed to federal regulation of their railroad. And so the abolitionists in Congress went to Lincoln and said, can you help us get the 13th Amendment passed by getting your friends in Senate, your Republican friends in the Senate, to drop this legislation? And Lincoln said no, he wouldn't do it. So not only was he not proactive, but when he was asked by the real abolitionist, he said, no thanks, I'm not going to help you. The theme of the Spielberg Lincoln movie is exactly the opposite. It's that Lincoln did everything to get the 13th Amendment passed. If it wasn't for him, it never would have been passed, is the theme of the movie. It is totally backwards. It's the opposite of the truth. So read that article. Also, there's another article that I wrote called Lincoln the Racist on LouRockwell.com that mentions the Spielberg movie. You can read that one too. And there it is. It's all, Cam already put it on the web, the chat. Let's see if there's any other Q&A here. So any other questions? Hang out a few more minutes, I guess. Check Q&A again. And Bob was asking, were there any protests about protective tariffs among northern farmers? Oh, yes. The Midwestern farmers in the late 19th century were a powerful anti-tariff voice. And it was because of this that the government got the income tax. I'm going to talk about that next week or 2 weeks from now. But the Midwestern farmers especially were were really screwed by this era of protectionism. And they were unsuccessful. They were not powerful enough to overwhelm the northern manufacturing interests who ran the Republican Party. The Republican Party was a monopoly, had a monopoly on politics in America for about 60 years. Even when Grover Cleveland was president, he was the last good Democrat is what I call Grover Cleveland. One of my articles years ago on LouRockwell.com was entitled The Last Good Democrat. Still, Republican policies more or less prevailed. And so they had a monopoly of power for a long time. And what would be the name of the system that replaced it? And we never did replace it. The Hamiltonianism has just festered up to this day. And when we see the bailouts by Bush and Obama, that was pure Hamiltonianism. In fact, the Midwest and the upper Midwest is where the so-called copperheads were centered. The big opposition to Lincoln, Lincoln's opponents, many of them were the farmers from the Midwest who were really, really harmed by his economic policies. And they were conscripted into his armies to go and kill their neighbors. And so the opposition to the war, much of the opposition to the war in the North and to Lincoln in the North came from the Midwestern farmers who were smeared and denigrated as copperheads or snakes in the grass. I think last week I mentioned a book on this by Frank Clement, spelled K-L-E-M-E-N-T, and it's Lincoln's Critics is the name of it, if you want to read something about the so-called copperhead. I'll give it one more shot in the Q&A here. Well, it looks like the class is running out of gas, which is fine. Okay, yeah, there's the article in the Daily Mail about Lincoln the racist, mainstream, so-called mainstream historians saying that the Spielberg movie is pretty phony. Yeah, Cam is talking about what he did when he brought this article to his class. Well, that, of course, is nonsense because the whole history profession has an ideological agenda. It's not as though you're an ideological agenda if you point out that the history profession is lying about Lincoln. Who has the agenda? The people who... and I quote in my article, Spielberg's Upside Down History, I quote at the beginning, at the top, Doris Kearns Goodwin, whose book the movie is based on, is saying, teams of researchers over the years have looked through Lincoln's writings and speeches and has not found him ever made a single racist act. And then right next to it, I quote one of Lincoln's white supremacist speeches from the Lincoln-Douglas debates. And so you have all these historians lying about Lincoln, and if you point out the lie, you've got an agenda. Cam's professor is saying. Cam's professor is full of it. And he agrees with me, yes he is. Okay, well it looks like we've run out of gas, so maybe we'll call it a night for tonight. And thanks again for everyone participating. I hope you learned something. And we'll continue on next week. Talking more about Lincoln's army and the Indians and the railroads and more in that part of history, working our way up to the Revolution of 1913. And thanks again for participating, and have a great week.